The information shared in this podcast does not necessarily represent EVRMA's stance. These podcasts are not a substitute for consultation with a physician. Hi, welcome to FertiliPod, a podcast by EVRMA. Hello, I'm Dr. Andres Rich. Welcome back to FertiliPod, the podcast where we discuss current topics and the latest research in the field of reproduction with some of the world's leading experts. Let's get started. In today's episode, we're sharing our latest EVRMA Global Journal Club, where we discuss the role of prednisone in recurrent implantation failure. Let's listen in. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Andres Rich, and I'm one of the current fellows at RMA New Jersey. I'm joined today by Dr. Amreselli to welcome you all to this EVRMA Journal Club. Today, we're going to have a presentation of an article published in JAMA in May of last year, Prednisone versus Placebo and Live Birth Rates in Patients with Recurrent Implantation Failure Undergoing In Vitro Fertilization, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This article is going to be presented by Dr. Pavan Gill, who's a third-year fellow here at RMA New Jersey. Her presentation will then be followed by a discussion by two of our expert panelists, Dr. Elena Labarta from IV Valencia and Dr. Filippo Baldi from EVRMA Italy. After the discussion, we're going to have time for some Q&A as well with everybody here in the audience. And of course, as usual, if you know anybody who couldn't make it today or you want to listen to this again some other time, this journal club is also going to be publicly available as a podcast in about 2 weeks through EVRMA's podcast, FertiliPod, which you can find on Apple, Spotify, anywhere that you can get your podcast. So now that our plan is clear, I think we'll get started right away. You can go ahead, Pavan.
Okay, perfect. So thank you so much for that introduction, Andres. So I will be going over the manuscript itself before we go into the discussion. So again, this was a paper titled Prednisone versus Placebo Live Birth in Patients with Recurrent Implantation Failure Undergoing IVF on RCT. Oh, sorry. So this was a study published last year in May of 2023 in JAMA, and it was essentially evaluating whether the use of 10 milligrams of prednisone in comparison to placebo would improve chances of live birth in patients with recurrent implantation failure. In their study, they did not find any benefit of using prednisone. And so over the course of the next 10 minutes, I'll go into more details regarding the study to catch everyone up before we start the discussion. So in their discussion, the authors first defined recurrent implantation failure as a failure to achieve a clinical pregnancy after repeated embryo transfers. They then described the role of an immunologic equilibrium as contributing to the establishment of implantation in early pregnancy, and they suggest that failed implantation could be explained in part by an immunologic dysfunction, including irregularities in cellular adhesion molecules, an imbalance in network of cytokines, as well as overactivity in uterine natural killer cells. To overcome this immunologic dysfunction, the use of prednisone has emerged as an adjunct therapy in patients with implantation failure. And potential mechanisms that are cited in the manuscript with respect to the impact of prednisone include potentially improving implantation by promoting trophoblast proliferation and invasion, normalizing cytokine expression and uterine natural killer cell activity, and stimulation of secretion of HCG. However, in their study, they discussed that there continue to remain limited studies on whether prednisone actually has any benefit. Importantly, there lacks any RCTs on evaluating the effect of prednisone specifically on live birth rate and recurrent implantation failure. And while some studies, including both retrospective and prospective studies, have shown potential benefit, there are concerns regarding their study methodology and applicability. And moreover, a recent Cochrane review of over 16 RCTs found that there was no benefit regarding steroid use in the IVF population. And so with all that in mind, the objective of this multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial was to evaluate whether the administration of prednisone would increase the rate of live births in women with recurrent implantation failure. We'll now go over the materials and methods. So again, this study was conducted at 8 fertility centers in China. Study participants included women with a history of recurrent implantation failure, which they define as failure to achieve a clinical pregnancy after 3 or more embryo transfer cycles, or 2 embryo transfer cycles with at least 3 embryos transferred. Importantly, they say that these should be good quality embryos. They do not mention PGT. And so they define these as at least being 4BC blastocyst or 7 to 10 cell stage if they're transferring cleavage stage embryos, which they do. Additional eligibility criteria include being less than 38 years old at time of egg retrieval, intending to undergo a frozen embryo transfer, and again, having at least 1 good quality blastocyst or 2 good quality cleavage embryos following IVF or ICSI or PGTA. With respect to randomization and blinding, participants were assigned to either receive 10 milligrams of prednisone or placebo tablets, and they ensured that the tablets were indistinguishable from each other. Block randomization was used, and again, this was a double-blinded study. Patients started taking either prednisone 10 milligrams by mouth daily or the placebo tablet at the onset of the frozen embryo transfer cycle. Importantly, all patients in the study underwent a programmed or cryosynthetic transfer cycle. Specifically, they took estradiol to achieve adequate endometrial proliferation. Those who had an endometrial thickness less than 6 millimeters were not included in the study. And for luteal phase support, they used either crinone vaginal gel or oral progesterone until about 8 to 12 weeks or the end of the first trimester. For the transfer, 1 good quality blastocyst or 2 good quality cleavage embryos were transferred, and patients were then followed from conception until end of pregnancy, and medical records were reviewed for the study. The primary outcome for the study was live birth rate after frozen embryo transfer cycle, which they define as a delivery after 28 weeks gestational age. So we don't get data on those very early preterm outcomes. Secondary outcomes included biochemical pregnancy, clinical pregnancy, implantation, pregnancy loss, pregnancy and perinatal complications, birth weight, congenital anomalies, and adverse events. A sample size calculation was performed based on an estimated live birth rate of 20% based on their review of the literature in women who failed 2 or more embryo transfer cycles. The study was designed to have 80% power to detect an absolute difference of 10% between the prednisone and the placebo groups with respect to live birth rate. And then they adjusted for a 15% dropout rate, resulting in a slightly higher sample size per group. With respect to their statistical analysis, the primary analysis was done by intention to treat, and a secondary per protocol analysis was also done. They did they also performed a logistic regression comparing both groups while adjusting for age, BMI, number of prior failed transfer cycles, the stage at which the embryo was transferred, so blastocyst versus cleavage stage study site. And they also did a post-hoc analysis stratified by the variables that are listed here. A p-value of less than 0.05 was significant. This is a pictorial figure just demonstrating the study design. So in total, they screened 1,027 women. 312 of these were excluded for the various reasons listed here. 715 were then included in the study and randomly assigned to either receive prednisone, 357 women, or placebo, 358 women. 47 women did not receive an embryo transfer or dropped out of the study, 27 in the prednisone arm and 20 in the placebo arm. 53 women also deviated from the protocol, so 28 women in the prednisone group and 25 in the placebo group. Importantly, the proportion of withdrawals and deviations was similar between the groups with a non-significant p-value of 0.27. 302 women in the prednisone group adhered to the protocol and 313 in the placebo group adhered to the protocol. And then these groups were analyzed both based on intention to treat and per protocol. We'll now go into the results. So first, we'll turn our attention to table one. So this describes the baseline characteristics of the participants. And overall, they were similar between the groups. The age was around 31 to 32 years old. The BMI on average was 22.7 in both groups. As we can see here, around a third of the patients had a prior history of miscarriage. Around 15% had a prior history of a live birth. The most common indication for IVF was tubal factor infertility. Going down a little bit further into the table, we can see that most patients on average had about 3 prior failed embryo transfers, and the majority of these were frozen. Now we'll look at table 2, which reports on the outcomes after endometrial preparation and embryo transfer. As we can see here, that the endometrial thickness prior to transfer was around 9 millimeters in both groups, and the majority of the transfers were single embryo transfer, but 27% and 26% in both groups were double embryo transfer. So almost a quarter of them were double embryo transfers. Most of the transfers were of day 5 or day 6 blastocysts, but again, nearly a quarter were day 3 transfers. And overall, they do report the euploid blastocyst transfer, and it was less than 10%, with 7.9% in the prednisone group and 5.9% in the placebo group. Now going on to the primary outcome live birth rate. In the intention to treat analysis, the live birth rate was 37.8% in the prednisone group and 38.8% in the placebo group with a non-significant p-value. The frequency of single live births was similar between both groups, and the frequency of twins was 4.2% in the prednisone group and 1.7% in the placebo group. Results of the per protocol analysis were also similar to the intention to treat analysis. This is data in their supplemental reports. And so the live birth rate was 40.7% in the prednisone group and 40.4% in the placebo group. Results of the logistic regression did not also reveal any significant association between prednisone use and live birth rate. Now, in terms of secondary outcomes, many of these are also described in the same table 3. And all of these are pretty much non-significant, except for the rate of biochemical pregnancy loss rate, which I've highlighted. So the biochemical pregnancy loss rate was, again, higher in the prednisone group compared to the placebo group at 17.3% versus 9.9%. And this was a significant p-value. They also have table 4, which includes additional secondary outcomes, specifically with respect to maternal, fetal, as well as neonatal adverse events. So again, just majority of these are non-significant, but I want to turn your attention to the significant ones. So the rate of preterm delivery was 11.8% in the prednisone group and 5.5% in the placebo group with a significant p-value. The rate of hyperemesis gravidarum, they also comment on, was significantly lower in the prednisone group at 0.6% versus 4.9% in the placebo group. Otherwise, there were no significant differences observed for the other secondary outcomes. Now, results of the per protocol analysis, again, which you can review in the supplemental data, were generally consistent with the intention to treat primary analysis, with the exception that the group differences that were noted with respect to the biochemical pregnancy loss rate and the preterm delivery rate were no longer significant. There are also no between group differences noted in live birth rate when looking at cleavage versus blastocyst transfers or among patients who had 2 versus 3 versus 4 versus 5 prior failed transfers. A post hoc analysis stratified by stage at which embryo was transferred, number of prior transfers, subgroup analysis based on age at egg retrieval, BMI, prior egg retrievals, and autoantibody positivity, which they also looked at, did not reveal any significant differences between both arms. Moving on to the discussion, they report that, you know, this is the largest multi-center randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial in that it included 715 women who failed 2 or more embryo transfers that evaluated the use of prednisone in the population. The live birth rate was 37.8% among women who received 10 milligrams of prednisone daily versus 38.8% in those who received a placebo, which was essentially a non-significant difference. And overall, these findings do not support the routine use of prednisone in patients with recurrent implantation failure. Importantly, in comparison to other literature that's out there, these findings are inconsistent with two prior trials that found benefit. But importantly, as they had mentioned in their introduction, there were limitations with respect to applicability of those studies due to methodologic differences. However, the findings of the current study are consistent with the Cochrane meta-analysis, which found no beneficial effect of prednisone in the IVF population. The authors then go on to describe potential explanations for some of the significant findings that they noted in the intention to treat analysis. So, for instance, the increased risk of biochemical pregnancy loss that was noted in the prednisone group could potentially be explained by the fact that prednisone does increase stimulation of HCG, but given it doesn't improve implantation, it resulted in a higher rate of biochemical pregnancy losses. With respect to that increased risk of preterm delivery that they noted, again, looking at deliveries between 28 weeks and up to less than 37 weeks gestational age in the prednisone group, they thought this could possibly be explained by that higher twin live birth rate in the prednisone group. Again, it was 4.2% versus less than 1% in the other arm. And then the less prevalence of hyperemesis in the prednisone group was not really that surprising, given that this medication is often used as a third-line agent for patients with severe hyperemesis. There are several strengths and limitations that they report, but of course, in the discussion, we'll go into this part a little bit further. So strengths include the study design being a multi-center, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, the primary outcome being very helpful clinically in that it was live birth rate, and the fact that they used frozen embryo transfer cycles, which is very relevant to just contemporary IVF practice. Of course, there are important limitations, some of which they comment on, which include that only a single regimen of steroid therapy was studied, so specifically prednisone 10 milligrams daily from onset of starting the transfer cycle. The study was not really powered to show many of the complications. And overall, these were pretty good prognosis patients. They had to have a good number of good quality embryos. They had a good BMI around less, so they were not overweight or obese. And overall, they were a relatively young population as well. So in conclusion, they report that among women with recurrent implantation failure, administration of 10 milligrams of prednisone in comparison to placebo did not significantly improve the live birth rate. Given the possible additional risk of preterm delivery and biochemical pregnancy loss associated potentially with administration, the data really do not support the routine use of 10 milligrams of prednisone in the treatment of patients with recurrent implantation failure. Thank you so much for your attention. I'll now turn it over to the rest of the speakers.
Thank you, Pavan. That was a great presentation, very interesting article with lots to discuss, from recurrent implantation failure to applicability, potential harm, lots of things. We'll now hear from our panelists, Elena, Filippo. Who wants to start?
I can start if you want. I mean, if you want to start. Okay, I can start. Pavan, you did a great job. You make a fantastic presentation of this manuscript. Of course, you showed all the strengths of these manuscripts, and you presented also the weakness of these manuscripts. But I believe that the most important weakness of this manuscript is that the patients included maybe is not really a RIF patients population, because the authors, of course, did not read our papers. That is impressed now in Human Reproduction, where we analyzed 120,000 single euploid blastocyst transfers, where we observed that up to the fifth embryo transfer, the live birth rate is still more than 50%. So in this group of patients, you saw that the mean age was 32. So it means that at 32, about 50% of the embryos were euploid, and they did not check for euploidy. So it means that when they transferred, 75% of these patients, when they transferred at the blastocyst stage, they needed 8 embryo, single embryo transfers to see any differences in terms of repeated implantation failure. And even when they transfer on two cleavage stage embryos, since about 50% will not reach a blastocyst stage, then again, they need 8 embryo transfers. So maybe the most of the population, the patient population were included in this study was not really a RIF population patients. And there's a lot of papers that demonstrated that the corticosteroids in the general population is absolutely useless. And we published 25 years ago, a paper, randomized controlled trial on human reproduction on the general population, more than 300 patients, and we did not observe any differences. So I think that the study design is perfect, but I think that the population that included were wrong. Again, our strength is that we can double this study in 1 month, 2 months, and so we can prove whether it's really like this. Elena, to you, and then maybe we can discuss about other, maybe not other patient population will benefit from corticosteroid administration, namely all those patients with serum antibodies, and then we can discuss on those group of patient populations.
Thank you, Filippo, and thank you, Pava, for the nice overview of the study. And I would like to congratulate the authors for having capable to recruit so many patients for a randomized control trial, because all researchers doing RCTs know the difficulty about recruiting so many patients. So obviously, we have to acknowledge this. But the thing is that, I think that for the beginning, the study was not going to show any difference because they calculated sample size to detect a 10% difference. And there is nothing in reproductive medicine that has demonstrated to improve 10% the chance of live birth. So from the beginning, the result was already known. Because it is impossible to improve 10%, and it was so difficult to find statistical differences. And in fact, they calculated the sample size estimating a live birth rate of 20% in the placebo group versus 30%. This is quite low. In fact, perhaps this was a strategy of the authors, because if you want to demonstrate an increase from 40 to 50%, you will need more patients, okay? So at the end, I don't know if it is a strategy or it is what they expected from the beginning. Because I miss the information about the expected cumulative implantation rate that they had with these previous transfers. In fact, the ESRE guidelines say that to define recurrent implantation failure, you have to be sure that you had previously more than 60% cumulative implantation rate. And as I agree with Filippo, that I'm not sure if these patients were really implantation failure patients. In fact, the mean number of cleavage stage embryos transferred was 2, and we cannot say that that the cumulative pregnancy rate could be higher than 60%. So obviously, any intervention in the general population is very difficult to prove to be effective in reproductive medicine. On the other hand, the rationale for giving prednisone is because it is an immunomodulatory factor and anti-inflammatory drug. And they included patients without any immunological disease or any inflammatory or inflammation in the genital tract. So it was very difficult to find a beneficial effect in this population with no pathologies. The dose of prednisone was low, was 10 milligrams. The author says this is to avoid the risk of infections, but we don't know if obviously giving a higher dose, we could have observed any difference, in fact, in when there are immunological factors, those given is higher. So probably giving 10 milligrams versus placebo is like the same. And it is difficult to find a beneficial effect with such a low dose. In any case, they say that the dose is safe, but obviously any drug can have a secondary or side effect. And in fact, they observed a higher biochemical brain acylose rate and a higher preterm birth. But we have to take into account that although the risk is low, the corticosteroids can increase the glucose levels, and this has to be taken into account in patients with insulin resistance or diabetes that are so frequent in our population. And, well, I think that the message is important, perhaps for the patients, because many of them are asking for add-on therapies just to do something different. I don't know if they are the patients or the doctors who don't know what to do, what else. But at the end, well, you can use this paper to say this has not been demonstrated to be effective in the general population, because I consider this population as a general population. And, I think that there is still a needing for doing studies in which prednisone could be beneficial, and they have to focus on patients who could need the treatment because they have any pathologies, and we need studies to demonstrate which is the ideal dose, which is the ideal set of patients who would benefit from that. Well, as always in medicine, I think that individualization is the key point here, and there is no general intervention for everyone that is going to prove to be effective, in my opinion.
Thank you. Thank you both. To continue with the discussion, we're going to open the floor to all of our audience. Please just raise your hand with the icon at the top, and we'll unmute your microphone so you can participate. Of course, anybody too shy to speak up can also use the chat. And then we have some other questions prepared for you as well. But we'll start with, I believe somebody's already...
I think Diana Alexander is raising her own hand, not the electronic hand.
She's raising her actual hand.
Oh, her physical hand.
Yes.
Go ahead, Diana.
Okay, thank you. I agree with Dr. Ubaldi and Dr. Labarta regarding the population. It's not a RIF population, first of all. And the second one, even if it would have been a RIF population, a RIF is a multifactorial problem, and the solution is not giving prednisolone. So in this case, treating general population with such a low dosage of prednisolone is similar to compared to placebo. So this study probably they waiting to see the same results. But another big limitation of the study is the hypothesis of the role of the prednisolone in a general healthy population on the embryo invasion. They said that the prednisolone could promote the trophoblast proliferation. I don't know where they took this information, physiological information. And the second one, it's about the proliferation and invasion and the modulation of the uterine NK cell activation. And we know that we need the uterine NK cell to be activated in order to promote the trophoblast invasion and placentation, and not to suppress the suppression of that activity. It's wrong and has a negative effect on the placentation and the invasion. So the hypothesis of using prednisolone for helping the trophoblast proliferation and invasion is wrong from an immunological and physiological point of view. And the second one, 10 milligrams of prednisolone, if we could think of some immunological factor is nothing. And they selected, of course, the general population, healthy women undergoing to a normal IVF without PGTA, without any other studies to see where they or if they have some trouble or just is some matter to keep transferring the embryos, reaching the number, the NAF number, which is good for having a good pregnancy rate. So they have many strong limitations from design or immunological hypothesis or an immunological point of view, a part of not RIF and a part of the other comments we already heard.
Yes, in fact, I'm surprised how a journal like JAMA could have been published, this paper. So,
yes, it's very strange.
Fair enough. I believe Dr. Andrea Borini wanted to make a comment as well.
Yeah, thank you. I think that JAMA published this paper just because it's the real world is that a lot of doctors just prescribe cortisone as soon as the patient has to fail the implantation. So that is the big problem because it's not defined very well the what is the repeated implantation failure. So I think that the old concept has to be changed, and that is the work and the job of the scientific societies, I think. But anyway, I see, at least in Italy, I see a lot of patients that have come out from centers where they have a long list of drugs cortisone is there, so every time. And sometimes they also ask back, why, doctor, you don't prescribe me something? Because in the other center where I failed my implantation, they prescribe a lot of drugs. So I think that JAMA is a journal for not for specialists, but for doctors, general doctors. So it is important that at least someone said that cortisone is not working in patients just have two or three transfers. So that I think that is important. Probably is the reason why the editor published this paper that I agree with you is not so strong paper.
This is actually a very good comment, and it brings me to something. But I just want to make a comment first, and I'll ask a question. There's the concept of hypothesis in these papers, but at least for research applications in the United States, we use the concept of premise. So the premise versus hypothesis is interesting. So you may say that your premise is that the world is flat, and then you could bring out not round, but flat. And then your hypothesis could be that if you keep walking, you'll fall off the side of the world. There's nothing wrong with your hypothesis, just your premise was wrong. And the issue with this paper is that they are assuming that people who transfer three embryos would have a lower implantation rate in their next transfer. Once you come up with that premise, which is essentially wrong, then you're spending all this money and effort. And at the end of the day, your and of course, Diana Alexander is right. We don't even know if there's a good reason to have the hypothesis that prednisone would work or not, but it becomes irrelevant. At the end of the day, as Filippo said, this becomes a study on would using prednisone or prednisone would work in someone who's doing IVF in general. So then it shows that it doesn't help. But what I thought was interesting here is the preterm birth rate. I mean, I just want to give a few also background information because this is an international audience. Unfortunately, preterm birth rate is higher in the United States with or without IVF. It is almost double of China. So in China, it's around 5%. In the United States, it's around 10%. It's an embarrassing rate. And in this study, the people who didn't get the placebo head was around 5, 6%, the regular rate in China. And with the prednisone, it really increased. And I don't know if it's just fluke, just an important side effect that we found here, we wouldn't be repeating. But I think it points out to the fact that, as Andrea Borini said, we shouldn't be giving unnecessary medications. But I want to ask Filippo's and Elena's opinion on the preterm birth thing. Is it worth checking in or giving medications without knowing the effect, like people give low NOx, other medications sometimes also.
I don't know really the preterm number here in Italy in the general population, and the only paper that we published recently was the preterm live birth rates comparing in the dual stimulation, comparing the babies born after the transfer of blastocyst coming from the follicular phase and the luteal phase, and then we did not observe any differences. But I cannot answer to your comments, Emre, because I do not know really which is the rate of preterm live birth rate in Italy, and of course is higher in IVF for sure, but especially for multiple pregnancies. Still in Italy, we still have a quite high twin pregnancies and rate, and then I think that the first thing to do is to do the single embryo transfer to reduce the multiple pregnancies. This is the most important thing, absolutely. Other thing that I could think about at the moment, no.
Same for us. I don't know by heart the percentage of preterm birth, but what is true is that the risk of preterm birth is significantly higher with twins. And that is why in our setting, we are doing single embryo transfer in 98% of patients. So obviously, we have decreased the risk of preterm birth because we have decreased the number.
We have 0.4% of twin pregnancies. So And all of them are monozygote pregnancies.
Well, do you see a lot of other medications being used in patients with recurrent with implantation failure, one or more? In addition, other than prednisone, do you see
other drugs for implantation failure patients? Yeah. Well, very very frequently aspirin. I mean, it's all those cheap treatments are so easily given because prednisone is cheap and aspirin is cheap, and no matter the scientific evidence, you are going to see many patients receiving this type of treatments.
Fair enough.
It is interesting. This may bring up the question. These medications, like you said, are cheap, but they're also cheap from a side effect point of view, right? Where they're often given under the premise they'll likely cause no harm and they may help. I think the study is a good, point where it brings into question the do no harm part. And even if it was just a fluke from the higher twin pregnancy rate, it's interesting that, perhaps these things that we think are so innocuous actually are causing harm, and could potentially have side effects that are actually negative for patients.
Yeah. Are there any other comments?
Can I say something?
Yeah,
regarding preterm birth, this study showed that they have more twins pregnancy in the prednisolone group, and they stopped the prednisolone at 12 weeks of pregnancy. So 10 milligrams of prednisone until 12 weeks of pregnancy for sure is very, very difficult to have an impact for the preterm birth. They didn't say anything about diabetes or other conditions those mothers could have presented during the pregnancy, which are more often involved in the complication, the obstetric complication. And another very interesting thing is they included frozen embryo transfer under hormonal substitutive therapy, which is very well known that only doing that there is an increased risk for obstetric complications in those pregnancies when we compare to natural pregnancies or transfer made in natural cycle. So they have many, many reasons for preterm birth, twins, frozen embryo transfer, no information about their outcome or their complications during the whole pregnancy. So it's very difficult to think of the prednisolone with 10 milligrams and stopped at 12 weeks of pregnancy. We know that the prednisolone could have this negative effect in preterm birth, but used through entire pregnancy in patients with a very severe autoimmune diseases with a higher dosage used until the end of the pregnancy, but not with 10 and only at the beginning of the pregnancy.
I think that this, perhaps this was an accidental finding. I mean, they had more twins in the prednisolone group, and that's why they had more preterm birth, but nothing to do with the prednisolone.
Of course, and this is the reason.
Probably. But still, there's still, it's probably better not to use medications that are not indicated. And that's one thing. And it's not helping in general IVF population. Are there any other comments, contributions?
But I would say that this is a very huge problem for doctors nowadays, because patients study a lot. Well, study, they read a lot. They don't study, they read in internet and everything. So they consider themselves as doctors, and they sometimes force you to give to receive some medication, and it is so difficult to convince them to not receiving medications that have not been demonstrated to be effective. And I think we have a very big problem with this nowadays.
Almost impossible to convince them. Almost impossible.
Yeah, because if not, they take this and they don't tell you. Okay.
So. Very good. Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody, so much. This is actually, we ended perfectly on time. This is all we have time for. This has been great. Amazing exchange of ideas, as usual. I'd like to thank you all for participating, especially Pavan, Elena, Filippo, and of course, Aitami, who helped coordinating. We hope you enjoyed today's Journal Club, and we hope to see you all for the next one, which will be on March 21st. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of FertilityPod by EVRMA. We hope you enjoyed it and that you'll subscribe or leave us a review to let us know how we're doing. Join us next time for more cutting-edge research, talks with renowned speakers, and all things reproductive medicine. See you next time.